Disc 3.
The drink gradually did good work. By the end of it, she was sufficiently recovered for habit of mind to assert itself. "God, I must look awful," she remarked. It did not seem that anyone but me was likely to be in a position to notice that, but I left it. She got up and walked over to a mirror. "I certainly do," she confirmed. "Where?" "Oh, you might try through there," I suggested. 20 minutes or so passed before she came back. Considering the limited facilities there must have been, she'd made a good job. Morale was much restored. She approximated now to the film director's idea of the heroine after a roughhouse, rather than the genuine thing. "Cigarette?" I inquired, as I slid another fortifying glass across. While the pulling round process was completing itself, we swapped stories. To give her time, I let her have mine first. Then she said, "I'm damned ashamed of myself. I'm not a bit like that, really. Like you found me, I mean. In fact, I'm reasonably self-reliant, though you might not think it. But somehow the whole thing had got too big for me. What's happened is bad enough, but the awful prospect suddenly seemed too much to bear, and I panicked. I began to think that perhaps I was the only person left in the whole world who could see. It got me down, and all at once I was frightened and silly. I cracked, and howled like a girl in a Victorian melodrama. I'd never, never have believed it of me."
"Don't let it worry you," I said. "We'll probably be learning a whole lot of surprising things about ourselves soon."
"But it does worry me. If I start off by slipping my gears like that..." She left the sentence unfinished.
"I was near enough to panic in that hospital," I said. "We're human beings, not calculating machines." Her name was Josella Platon. There seemed to be something not unfamiliar about that, but I could not place it. Her home was in Dean Road, St. John's Wood. The district fitted in more or less with my surmises. I remembered Dean Road. Detached, comfortable houses, mostly ugly, but all expensive. Her escape from the general affliction had been no less a matter of luck than mine, well, perhaps more. She had been at a party on the Monday night. A pretty considerable party, it seemed. "I reckon somebody who thinks that kind of thing funny must have been fooling with the drinks," she said. "I've never felt so ill as I did at the end of it, and I didn't take a lot." Tuesday she recollected as a day of blurred misery and record hangover. About 4 in the afternoon she had had more than enough of it. She rang the bell and gave instructions that come comets, earthquakes, or the Day of Judgment itself, she was not to be disturbed. Upon that ultimatum she had taken a strong dose of sleeping draught, which on an empty stomach had worked with the efficiency of a knockout drop. From then on she had known nothing until this morning, when she had been awakened by her father stumbling into her room.
"Josella," he was saying, "for God's sake get Dr. Mayle. Tell him I've gone blind. Stone blind."
She had been amazed to see that it was already almost 9 o'clock. She got up and dressed hurriedly. The servants had answered neither her father's bell nor her own. When she went to rouse them, she had found to her horror that they, too, were blind. With the telephone out of order, the only course seemed to be for her to take the car and fetch the doctor himself. The quiet streets and absence of traffic had seemed queer. But she had already driven almost a mile before it came to her what had happened. When she realized, she had all but turned back in panic. But that wasn't going to do anyone any good. There still was the chance that the doctor might have escaped the malady, whatever it was, just as she had herself. So with a desperate but waning hope, she had driven on. Halfway down Regent Street, the engine started to miss and splutter. Finally it stopped. In her hurried start, she had not looked at the gauge. It was the reserve tank she had run dry. She sat there for a moment, dismayed. Every face in sight was now turned towards her, but she had realized by this time that not one of those she saw could see or help her. She got out of the car, hoping to find a garage somewhere nearby, or if there was none, prepared to walk the rest of the way. As she slammed the door behind her, a voice called,
"Hey! Just a minute, mate."
She turned and saw a man groping towards her.
"What is it?"
she asked. She was by no means taken with the look of him. His manner changed on hearing her voice.
"I'm lost.
Don't know where I am. This is Regent Street. The New Gallery Cinema's just behind you, she told him, and turned to go. Just show me where the curb is, miss, will you? He said. She hesitated, and in that moment he came close. The outstretched hand sought and touched her sleeve. He lunged forward and caught both her arms in a painful grip.
So you can see, can you? He said. Why the hell should you be able to see when I can't, nor anyone else?
Before she could realize what was happening, he had turned her and tripped her, and she was lying in the road with his knee in her back. He caught both her wrists in the grasp of one large hand and proceeded to tie them together with a piece of string from his pocket. Then he stood up and pulled her onto her feet again.
All right, he said. From now on you can do your scene for me. I'm hungry. Take me where there's a bit of good grub. Get on with it.
Josella dragged away from him.
I won't. Undo my hands at once.
He cut that short with a smack across her face.
That'll be enough of that, Margot. Come on now, get cracking. Food, you hear?
I won't, I tell you.
You bloody well will, my girl, he assured her.
And she had. She'd done it, watching all the time for a chance to get away. And he'd been expecting just that. Once she almost brought it off, but he had been too quick. Even as she had pulled free, he had put out a foot to trip her, and before she could get up, he had a grip on her again. After that, he had found the strong cord and tethered her to his wrist. She had led him first to a cafe and directed him to a refrigerator. The machine was no longer working, but it was stored with food that was still fresh. The next call was a bar where he wanted Irish whiskey. She could see it, perched up on a shelf beyond his reach.
If you'd untie my hands, she suggested. What, and have you crowned me with a bottle? I wasn't born yesterday, my girl. No, I'll have the scotch. Which is it?
She told him what was in the various bottles as he laid his hand on them.
I think I must have been dazed, she explained. I can see now half a dozen ways I could have outwitted him. Probably I'd have killed him later on if you hadn't come along.
But you can't change and turn brutal all at once. At least I can't. I didn't seem to be able to think properly at first. I'd a sort of feeling that things like that didn't happen nowadays, and that somebody would come along and stop it soon.
There had been a row in that bar before they left. Another party of men and women discovered the open door and came in. Incautiously, her captor instructed her to tell them what was in the bottle they found. At that, they all stopped talking and turned their sightless eyes towards her. There was a whisper, then two men stepped warily forward. They had a purposeful look on their faces. She jerked at the cord.
Look out! She cried.
Without the least hesitation, her captor swung out his boot. It was a lucky kick. One of the men folded up with a yell of pain. The other jumped forward, but she sidestepped and he brought up against the counter with a crash.
You bloody well leave her alone!
Roared the man who held her. He turned his face menacingly this way and that.
She's mine, blast you! I found her!
But it was clear that the rest were not intending to give up that easily. Even had they been able to see the danger in her companion's expression, it would not have been likely to stop them. Josella started to realize that the gift of sight, even at second hand, was now something vastly surpassing all riches, and the chance of it not to be released without bitter contest. The others began to close in, with their hands questing in front of them. Reaching out with one foot, she hooked the leg of a chair and overturned it in their way.
Come on!
She cried, dragging the other man back. Two men tripped over the fallen chair and a woman fell on top of them. Swiftly, the place became a struggling confusion. She steered away through it, and they escaped into the street. She scarcely knew why she did it, save that the prospect of being enslaved to act as the eyes of that group had seemed even worse than her present plight. Nor did the man give her any thanks. He merely directed her to find another bar, an empty one.
I think, she said judicially, that though you wouldn't have guessed it to look at him, he wasn't perhaps too bad a man, really. Only he was frightened. Deep down inside him, he was much more frightened than I was. He gave me some food and something to drink. He only started beating me like that because he was drunk, and I wouldn't go into his house with him. I don't know what would have happened if you hadn't come along.
She paused. Then she added, "But I am pretty ashamed of myself. Shows you what a modern young woman can come to after all, doesn't it? Screaming and collapsing with the vapours, hell!"
She was looking and obviously feeling rather better, though she winced as she reached for her glass.
"I think," I said, "that I've been fairly dense over this business. I'm pretty lucky. I ought to have made more of the implications when I saw that woman with the child in Piccadilly. It's only been chance that stopped me from falling into the same kind of mess that you did.
Anybody who has had a great treasure has always led a precarious existence," she said reflectively.
"I'll go on bearing that in mind henceforth," I told her.
"It's already very well impressed on mine," she remarked.
We sat listening to the uproar from the other pub for a few minutes. "And what," I said at last, "just what do we propose to do now?"
"I must get back home. There's my father. It's obviously no good going on to try and find the doctor now, even if he has been one of the lucky ones."
She seemed about to add something, but hesitated. "Do you mind if I come too?" I asked. "This doesn't seem to me the sort of time when anyone like us should be wandering about on his or her own." She turned with a grateful look.
"Thank you. I almost asked, but I thought there might be somebody you'd be wanting to look for."
"There isn't," I said. "Not in London, at any rate."
"I'm glad. It's not so much that I'm afraid of getting caught again. I'll be much too careful for that. But to be honest, it's the loneliness I'm afraid of. I'm beginning to feel so cut off and stranded."
I was starting to see things in another new light. The sense of release was tempered with a growing realization of the grimness that might lie ahead of us. It had been impossible at first not to feel some superiority and therefore confidence. Our chances of surviving the catastrophe were a million times greater than those of the rest. Where they must fumble, grope, and guess, we had simply to walk in and take. But there were going to be a lot of things beyond that.
I said, "I wonder just how many of us have escaped and can still see. I've come across one other man, a child, and a baby. You've met none. It looks to me as if we're going to find out that sight is very rare indeed. Some of the others have evidently grasped already that their only chance of survival is to get hold of someone who can see. When they all understand that, the outlook's going to be none too good."
The future seemed to me at that time a choice between a lonely existence, always in fear of capture, or of gathering together a selected group which we could rely on to protect us from other groups. We'd be filling a kind of leader-come-prisoner role, and along with it went a nasty picture of bloody gang wars being fought for possession of us. I was still uncomfortably elaborating these possibilities when Josella recalled me to the present by getting up.
"I must go," she said. "Poor father, it's after 4 o'clock.
Back in Regent Street again, a thought suddenly struck me. "Come across," I said. "I fancy I remember a shop somewhere here." The shop was still there. We equipped ourselves with a couple of useful-looking sheath knives and belts to carry them.
"Makes me feel like a pirate," said Josella, as she buckled hers on.
"Better, I imagine, to be a pirate than a pirate's moll," I told her. A few yards up the street we came upon a large, shiny saloon car. It looked the kind of craft that should simply have purred. But the noise when I started it up sounded louder in our ears than all the normal traffic of a busy street. We made our way northward, zigzagging to avoid derelicts and wanderers stricken into immobility in the middle of the road by the sound of our approach. All the way heads turned hopefully towards us as we came, and faces fell as we went past. One building on our route was blazing fiercely, and a cloud of smoke rose from another fire somewhere along Oxford Street. There were more people about in Oxford Circus, but we got through them neatly, then past the BBC, and so north to the carriageway in Regent's Park. It was a relief to get out of the streets and reach an open space, and one where there were no unfortunate people wandering and groping. The only moving things we could see on the broad stretches of grass were two or three little groups of triffids lurching southwards.
Somehow or other, they had contrived to pull up their stakes and were dragging them along behind them on their chains. I remembered that there were some undocked specimens, a few tethered, but most of them double-fenced, in an enclosure beside the zoo, and wondered how they had got out. Josella noticed them too. "It's not going to make much difference to them," she said. For the rest of the way, there was little to delay us. Within a few minutes I was pulling up at the house, she pointed out. We got out of the car, and I pushed open the gate. A short drive curved round a bed of bushes which hid most of the house front from the road. As we turned the corner, Josella gave a cry and ran forward. A figure was lying on the gravel, chest downwards, but with the head turned to show one side of its face. The first glance at it showed me the bright red streak across its cheek.
"Stop!"
I shouted at her. There was enough alarm in my voice to check her. I had spotted the triffid now. It was lurking among the bushes, well within striking range of the sprawled figure.
"Back, quick!"
I said. Still looking at the man on the ground, she hesitated.
"But I must..."
she began, turning towards me. Then she stopped. Her eyes widened, and she screamed. I whipped round to find a triffid towering only a few feet behind me. In one automatic movement, I had my hands over my eyes. I heard the sting whistle as it lashed out at me, but there was no knockout, no agonized burning, even. One's mind can move like lightning at such a moment. Nevertheless, it was more instinct than reason which sent me leaping at it before it had time to strike again. I collided with it, overturning it, and even as I went down with it, my hands were on the upper part of its stem trying to pull off the cap and the sting. Triffid stems do not snap, but they can be mangled. This one was mangled thoroughly before I stood up. Josella was standing in the same spot, transfixed. "Come here," I told her. "There's another in the bushes behind you." She glanced fearfully over her shoulder and came.
"But it hit you," she said incredulously. "Why aren't you..."
"I don't know. I ought to be," I said. I looked down at the fallen triffid. Suddenly remembering the knives that we'd acquired with quite other enemies in mind, I used mine to cut off the sting at its base. I examined it. "That explains it," I said, pointing to the poison sacs. "See? They're collapsed, exhausted. If they'd been full, or even part full..." I turned a thumb down. I had that and my acquired resistance to the poison to thank. Nevertheless, there was a pale red mark across the back of my hands and my neck that was itching like the devil. I rubbed it while I stood looking at the sting.
"It's queer,"
I murmured, more to myself than to her, but she heard me.
"What's queer?"
"I've never seen one with the poison sacs quite empty like this before. It must have been doing a hell of a lot of stinging." But I doubt if she heard me. Her attention had reverted to the man who was lying in the drive, and she was eyeing the triffid standing by.
"How can we get him away?"
she asked. "We can't, not till that thing's been dealt with," I told her. "Besides..." "Well, I'm afraid we can't help him now."
"You mean he's dead?"
I nodded. "Yes. There's not a doubt of it. I've seen others who've been stung. Who was he?" I added.
"Old Pearson. He did gardening for us and chauffeuring for my father. Such a dear old man. I've known him all my life."
"I'm sorry," I began, wishing I could think of something more adequate, but she cut me short.
"Look! Oh, look!"
She pointed to a path which ran round the side of the house. A black-stockinged leg with a woman's shoe on it protruded round the corner. We prospected carefully, and then moved safely to a spot which gave a better view. A girl in a black dress lay half on the path and half in a flower bed. Her pretty, fresh face was scarred with a bright red line. Josella choked. Tears came into her eyes.
"Oh. Oh, it's Annie. Poor little Annie,"
she said. I tried to console her a little. "They can scarcely have known it, either of them," I told her. "When it's strong enough to kill, it's mercifully quick." We did not see any other triffid in hiding there. Possibly it was the same one that had attacked them both. Together we crossed the path and got into the house by the side door. Josella called. There was no answer. She called again. We both listened in the complete silence that wrapped the house. She turned to look at me. Neither of us said anything. Quietly she led the way along a passage to a baize-covered door. As she opened it, there was a swish, and something slapped across door and frame an inch or so above her head. Hurriedly she pulled the door shut again and turned wide-eyed to me.
"There's one in the hall," she said.
She spoke in a frightened half-whisper, as though it might be listening. We went back to the outer door and into the garden once more. Keeping to the grass for silence, we made our way round the house until we could look into the lounge hall. The French window which led from the garden was open, and the glass of one side was shattered. A trail of muddy blobs led over the step and across the carpet. At the end of it, a triffid stood in the middle of the room. The top of its stem almost brushed the ceiling, and it was swaying ever so slightly. Close beside its damp, shaggy bowl lay the body of an elderly man clad in a bright silk dressing gown. I took hold of Gisella's arm. I was afraid she might rush in there. "Is it your father?" I asked, though I knew it must be. "Yes," she said, and put her hands over her face. She was trembling slightly. I stood still, keeping an eye on the triffid inside, lest it should move our way. Then I thought of a handkerchief and handed her mine. There wasn't much anyone could do. After a little while, she took more control of herself. Remembering the people we had seen that day, I said, "You know, I think I would rather that had happened to me than be like those others." "Yes," she said, after a pause. She looked up into the sky. It was a soft, depthless blue with a few little clouds floating like white feathers. "Oh, yes," she repeated with more conviction. "Poor Daddy. He couldn't have stood blindness. He loved all this too much." She glanced inside the room again. "What shall we do? I can't leave." At that moment I caught the reflection of movement in the remaining window pane. I looked behind us quickly to see a triffid break clear of the bushes and start across the lawn. It was lurching on a line that led straight towards us. I could hear the leathery leaves rustling as the stem whipped back and forth. There was no time for delay. I had no idea how many more there might be round the place. I grabbed Gisella's arm again and ran her back by the way we had come. As we scrambled safely into the car, she burst into real tears at last. She would be the better for having her cry out. I lit a cigarette and considered the next move. Naturally, she was not going to care for the idea of leaving her father as we had found him. She would wish that he should have a proper burial, and by the looks of it, that would be a matter of the pair of us digging the grave and effecting the whole business. And before that could even be attempted, it would be necessary to fetch the means to deal with the triffids that were already there, and keep off any more that might appear. On the whole, I would be in favour of dropping the whole thing. But then, it was not my father. The more I considered this new aspect of things, the less I liked it. I had no idea how many triffids there might be in London. Every park had a few at least. Usually they kept some docked ones that were allowed to roam about as they would. Often there were others with stings intact, either staked or safely behind wire netting. Thinking of those we had seen crossing Regent's Park, I wondered just how many they had been in the habit of keeping in the pens by the zoo, and how many had escaped. There'd be a number in private gardens, too. You'd expect all those to be safely docked, but you never can tell what fool carelessness may go on. And then there were several nurseries of the things, and experimental stations a little further out. While I sat there pondering, I was aware of something nudging at the back of my mind, some association of ideas that didn't quite join up. I sought it for a moment or two, then suddenly it came. I could almost hear Walter's voice speaking, saying, "I tell you, a triffid's in a damn sight better position to survive than a blind man." Of course, he had been talking about a man who had been blinded by a triffid sting. All the same, it was a jolt, more than a jolt. It scared me a bit. I thought back. No, it had just arisen out of general speculation. Nevertheless, it seemed a bit uncanny now.
Take away our sight, he had said, and our superiority to them is gone.
Of course, coincidences are happening all the time, but it's just now and then you happen to notice them. A crunch on the gravel brought me back to the present. A Triffid came swaying down the drive towards the gate. I leant across and screwed up the window.
Drive on! Drive on! Said Josella hysterically.
We're all right here, I told her. I want to see what it does. Simultaneously, I realized that one of my questions was solved. Being accustomed to Triffids, I had forgotten how most people felt about an undocked one. I suddenly understood that there would be no question of coming back here. Josella's feeling about an armed Triffid was the general idea. Get well away from it and stay away. The thing paused by the gatepost. One could have sworn that it was listening. We sat perfectly still and quiet, Josella staring at it with horror. I expected it to lash out at the car, but it didn't. Probably the muffling of our voices inside had misled it into thinking we were out of range. The little bare stalks began abruptly to clatter against its stem. It swayed, lumbered clumsily off to the right, and disappeared into the next driveway. Josella gave a sigh of relief.
Oh, let's get away before it comes back, she implored.
I started the car, turned it round, and we drove off Londonwards again. Chapter 5 A Light in the Night. Josella began to recover her self-possession. With the deliberate and obvious intention of taking her mind off what lay behind us, she asked,
Where are we going now?
Clerkenwell first, I told her. After that, we'll see about getting you some more clothes. Bond Street for them if you like, but Clerkenwell first.
But why Good heavens!
She might well exclaim. We had turned a corner to see the street 70 yards ahead of us filled with people. They were coming towards us at a stumbling run, with their arms outstretched before them. A mingled crying and screaming came from them. Even as we turned into sight of them, a woman at the front tripped and fell. Others tumbled over her, and she disappeared beneath a kicking, struggling heap. Beyond the mob, we had a glimpse of the cause of it all. 3 dark-leaved stalks swaying over the panic-stricken heads. I accelerated and swung off into a byroad. Josella turned a terrified face.
Did you see what that was? They were driving them.
Yes. I said. That's why we're going to Clerkenwell. There's a place there that makes the best Triffid guns and masks in the world. We worked back again and picked up our intended route, but we did not find the clear run I had hoped for. Near King's Cross Station there were many more people on the streets. Even with a hand on the horn it was increasingly difficult to get along. In front of the station itself it became impossible. Why there should have been such crowds in that place I don't know. All the people in the district seemed to have converged upon it. We could not get through the people, and a glance behind showed that it would be almost as hopeless to try to go back. Those we had passed had already closed in on our track. Get out quick, I said. I think they're after us.
But,
Josella began.
Hurry,
I said shortly. I blew a final blast on the horn and slipped out after her, leaving the engine running. We were not many seconds too soon. A man found the handle of the rear door. He pulled it open and poured inside. We were all but pushed over by the pressure of others making for the car. There was a shout of anger when somebody opened the front door and found the seats there empty too. By that time we had ourselves safely become members of the crowd. Somebody grabbed the man who had opened the rear door, under the impression that it was he who had just got out. Around that the confusion began to thrive. I took a firm grip of Josella's hand and we started to worm our way out as unobviously as possible. Clear of the crowd at last, we kept on foot for a while, looking out for a suitable car. After a mile or so we found it, a station wagon, likely to be more useful than an ordinary body for the plan that was beginning to form vaguely in my mind. In Clerkenwell, they had been accustomed for 2 or 3 centuries to make fine, precise instruments. The small factory I had dealt with professionally at times had adapted the old skill to new needs. I found it with little difficulty, nor was it hard to break in. When we set off again, there was a comforting sense of support to be derived from several excellent Triffid guns, some thousands of little steel boomerangs for them, and some wire mesh helmets that we had loaded into the back.
And now, clothes?
Suggested Josella as we started. Provisional plan open to criticism and correction, I told her. First, what you might call a pied-à-terre, i.e. somewhere to pull ourselves together and discuss things.
Not another bar, she protested. I've had quite enough of bars for one day.
Improbable though my friends might think it, with everything free, so have I agreed. What I was thinking of was an empty flat. That shouldn't be difficult to find. We could ease up there a while and settle the rough plan of campaign. Also, it would be convenient for spending the night. Or, if you find the trammels of convention still defy the peculiar circumstances, well, maybe we could make it two flats.
I think I'd be happier to know there was someone close at hand.
Okay, I agreed. Then operation number two will be ladies and gents outfitting. For that, perhaps we had better go our separate ways, both taking exceedingly good care not to forget which flat it was that we decided on.
Yes, she said, but a little doubtfully.
It'll be all right, I assured her. Make a rule for yourself not to speak to anyone, and nobody's going to guess that you can see. It was only being quite unprepared that landed you in that mess before. In the country of the blind, the one-eyed man is king.
Oh, yes. Wells said that, didn't he?
Only, in the story, it turned out not to be true. Well, the crux of the difference lies in what you mean by the word country, patria, in the original, I said. Cae coram in patria luscus rex imperat omnis. A classical gentleman called Philonius said it first. It's all anyone seems to know about him. But there's no organized patria, no state here. Only chaos. Wells imagined a people who had adapted themselves to blindness. I don't think that's going to happen here. I don't see how it can.
What do you think is going to happen?
My guess would be no better than yours. And soon we shall begin to know, anyway. Better get back to matters in hand. Where were we?
Choosing clothes.
Oh, yes. Well, it's simply a matter of slipping into a shop, adopting a few trifles, and slipping out again. You'll not meet any Triffids in central London, at least not yet.
You talk so lightly about taking things, she said.
I don't feel quite so lightly about it, I admitted. But I'm not sure that that's virtue, it's more likely merely habit. And an obstinate refusal to face facts isn't going to bring anything back or help us at all. I think we'll have to try to see ourselves not as the robbers of all this, but more as, well, the unwilling heirs to it.
Yes, I suppose it is something like that, she agreed, in a qualified way.
She was silent for a time. When she spoke again, she reverted to the earlier question.
And after the clothes? She asked.
Operation number three, I told her, is quite definitely dinner. There was, as I had expected, no great difficulty about the flat. We left the car locked up in the middle of the road in front of an opulent-looking block and climbed to the third story. Quite why we chose the third, I can't say, except that it seemed a bit more out of the way. The process of selection was simple. We knocked or we rang, and if anyone answered, we passed on. After we had passed on three times, we found a door where there was no response. The socket of the rimlock tore off to one good heft of the shoulder, and we were in. I had not, myself, been one of those addicted to living in a flat with a rent of some £2,000 a year, but I found that there were decidedly things to be said in favour of it. The interior decorators had been, I guessed, elegant young men with just that ingenious gift for combining taste with advanced topicality, which is so expensive. Consciousness of fashion was the mainspring of the place. Here and there were certain unmistakable dernier cri, some of them undoubtedly destined, had the world pursued its expected course, to become the rage of tomorrow. Others, I would say, a dead loss from their very inception. The overall effect was all trade fair in its neglect of human foibles. A book left a few inches out of place or with the wrong colour on its jacket would ruin the whole carefully considered balance and tone. So, too, with the person thoughtless enough to wear the wrong clothes when sitting upon the wrong luxurious chair or sofa. I turned to Gisella, who was staring wide-eyed at it all. "Will this little shack serve, or do we go further?" I asked.
"Oh, I guess we'll make out,"
she said, and together we waded through the delicate cream carpet to explore. It was quite uncalculated, but I could scarcely have hit upon a more satisfactory method of taking her mind off the events of the day. Our tour was punctuated with a series of exclamations in which admiration, envy, delight, contempt, and, one must confess, malice, all played their parts. Gisella paused on the threshold of a room rampant with all the most aggressive manifestations of femininity. "I'll sleep here," she said. "My God," I remarked. "Well, each to her taste." "Don't be nasty. I probably won't have another chance to be decadent. Besides, don't you know there's a bit of the dumbest film star in every girl, so I'll let it have its final fling." "You shall," I said. "But I hope they keep something quieter around here. Heaven preserve me from having to sleep in a bed with a mirror set in the ceiling over it." "There's one above the bath, too," she said, looking into an adjoining room. "I don't know whether that would be the zenith or nadir of decadence," I said. "But anyway, you'll not be using it. No hot water."
"Oh, I'd forgotten that. What a shame," she exclaimed disappointedly.
We completed our inspection of the premises, finding the rest less sensational. Then she went out to deal with the matter of clothes. I made an inspection of the apartment's resources and limitations, and then set out on an expedition of my own. As I stepped outside, another door farther down the passage opened. I stopped and stood still where I was. A young man came out, leading a fair-haired girl by the hand. As she stepped over the threshold, he released his grasp.
"Wait just a minute, darling," he said.
He took three or four steps on the silencing carpet. His outstretched hands found the window which ended the passage. His fingers went straight to the catch and opened it. I had a glimpse of a fire escape outside.
"What are you doing, Jimmy?" she asked.
"Just making sure," he said, stepping quickly back to her and feeling for her hand again.
"Come along, darling."
She hung back.
"Jimmy, I don't like leaving here. At least we know where we are in our own flat. How are we going to feed? How are we going to live?"
"In the flat, darling, we shan't feed at all, and therefore not live long."
"Come along, sweetheart, don't be afraid." "But I am, Jimmy, I am."
She clung to him, and he put one arm round her.
"We'll be all right, darling, come along." "But Jimmy, that's the wrong way."
"No, you've got it twisted round, dear, it's the right way."
"Jimmy, I'm so frightened, let's go back."
"It's too late, darling." By the window he paused. With one hand he felt his position very carefully. Then he put both arms round her, holding her to him.
"Too wonderful to last, perhaps," he said softly. "I love you, my sweet. I love you so very, very much."
She turned her lips up to be kissed. As he lifted her, he turned and stepped out of the window. "You've got to grow a hide," I told myself. "Got to. It's either that or stay permanently drunk. Things like that must be happening all around. They'll go on happening. You can't help it. Suppose you'd given them food to keep them alive for another few days. What after that? You've got to learn to take it and come to terms with it. There's nothing else but the alcoholic funk hole. If you don't fight to live your own life in spite of it, there won't be any survival. Only those who can make their minds tough enough to stick it are going to get through." It took me longer than I had expected to collect what I wanted. Something like 2 hours had passed before I got back. I dropped one or two things from my armful in negotiating the door. Gisella's voice called with a trace of nervousness from that over-feminine room. "Only me," I reassured her as I advanced down the passage with the load. I dumped the things in the kitchen and went back for those I'd dropped. Outside her door, I paused.
"You can't come in," she said.
"That wasn't quite my intended angle," I protested. "What I want to know is, can you cook?"
"Boiled egg standard," said her muffled voice.
I was afraid of that. "There's an awful lot of things we're going to have to learn," I told her. I went back to the kitchen. I erected the oil stove I had brought on top of the useless electric cooker and got busy. When I'd finished laying the places at the small table in the sitting room, the effect seemed to me fairly good. I fetched a few candles and candlesticks to complete it and set them ready. Of Josella there was still no visible sign, though there had been sounds of running water some little time ago. I called her.
"Just coming,"
she answered. I wandered across to the window and looked out. Quite consciously, I began saying goodbye to it all. The sun was low. Towers, spires, facades of Portland stone were white or pink against the dimming sky. More fires had broken out here and there. The smoke climbed in big black smudges, sometimes with a lick of flame at the bottom of them. Quite likely, I told myself, I would never in my life again see any of these familiar buildings after tomorrow. There might be a time when one would be able to come back, but not to the same place. Fires and weather would have worked on it. It would be visibly dead and abandoned. But now, at a distance, it could still masquerade as a living city. My father once told me that before Hitler's war he used to go around London with his eyes more widely open than ever before, seeing the beauties of buildings that he had never noticed before, and saying goodbye to them. And now I had a similar feeling. But this was something worse. Much more than anyone could have hoped for had survived that war. But this was an enemy they would not survive. It was not wanton smashing and willful burning that they waited for this time. It was simply the long, slow, inevitable course of decay and collapse. Standing there, and at that time, my heart still resisted what my head was telling me. Even yet I had the feeling that it was all something too big, too unnatural, really to happen. Yet I knew that it was by no means the first time that it had happened. The corpses of other great cities are lying buried in deserts and obliterated by the jungles of Asia. Some of them fell so long ago that even their names have gone with them. But to those who lived there, their dissolution can have seemed no more probable or possible than the necrosis of a great modern city seemed to me. It must be, I thought, one of the race's most persistent and comforting hallucinations to trust that it can't happen here, that one's own little time and place is beyond cataclysms. And now it was happening here. Unless there should be some miracle, I was looking on the beginning of the end of London. And very likely it seemed there were other men, not unlike me, who were looking on the beginning of the end of New York, Paris, San Francisco, Buenos Aires, Bombay, and all the rest of the cities that were destined to go the way of those others under the jungles. I was still looking out when a sound of movement came from behind me. I turned and saw that Josella had come into the room. She was wearing a long, pretty frock of palest blue georgette with a little jacket of white fur. In a pendant on a simple chain, a few blue-white diamonds flashed. The stones that gleamed in her ear clips were smaller but as fine in colour. Her hair and her face might have been fresh from a beauty parlour. She crossed the floor with a flicker of silver slippers and a glimpse of gossamer stockings. As I went on staring without speaking, her mouth lost its little smile. "Don't you like it?" she asked, with childish half-disappointment.
"It's lovely."
"You're beautiful," I told her.
I just wasn't expecting anything like this."
Something more was needed. I knew that it was a display which had little or nothing to do with me. I added, "You're saying goodbye." A different look came into her eyes.
"So you do understand. I hoped you would."
"I think I do. I'm glad you've done it. It'll be a lovely thing to remember," I said. I stretched out my hand to her and led her to the window. I was saying goodbye to all this. What went on in her mind as we stood there side by side is her secret. In mine there was a kind of kaleidoscope of the life and ways that were now finished. Or perhaps it was more like flipping through a huge volume of photographs with one all-comprehensive, "Do you remember?" We looked for a long time, lost in our thoughts. Then she sighed.
She glanced down at her dress, fingering the delicate silk.
Silly? Rome burning? She said, with a rueful little smile.
No, sweet, I said. Thank you for doing it. A gesture, and a reminder that with all the faults there was so much beauty. You couldn't have done or looked a lovelier thing. Her smile lost its ruefulness.
Thank you, Bill.
She paused. Then she added,
Have I said thank you before? I don't think I have. If you hadn't helped me when you did.
But for you, I told her, I should probably by now be lying maudlin and sozzled in some bar. I have just as much to thank you for. This is no time to be alone. Then, to change the trend, I added,
And speaking of drink, there's an excellent Amontillado here and some pretty good things to follow. This is a very well-found flat.
I poured out the sherry, and we raised our glasses. To health, strength, and luck, I said. She nodded. We drank.
What, Josella asked as we started on an expensive-tasting pâté, what if the owner of all this suddenly comes back?
In that case we will explain, and he or she should be only too thankful to have someone here to tell him which bottle is which, and so on. But I don't think that is very likely to happen.
No, she agreed, considering. No, I'm afraid that's not very likely.
I wonder... She looked round the room. Her eyes paused at a fluted white pedestal.
Did you try the radio? I suppose that thing is a radio, isn't it?
It's a television projector, too, I told her. But no good. No power.
Of course, I forgot. I suppose we'll go on forgetting things like that for quite a time.
But I did try one when I was out, I said. A battery affair. Nothing doing. All broadcast bands are silent as the grave.
That means it's like this everywhere?
I'm afraid so. There was something pip-pipping away around 42 meters. Otherwise nothing. Not even carriers.
I wonder who and where he was, poor chap. It's going to be pretty grim, Bill, isn't it?
No, I'm not going to have my dinner clouded, I said. Pleasure before business, and the future is definitely business. Let's talk about something interesting, like how many love affairs you've had and why somebody hasn't married you long before this. Or has he? You see how little I know. Life story, please.
Well, she said, I was born about 3 miles from here. My mother was very annoyed about it at the time.
I raised my eyebrows.
You see, she had quite made up her mind that I should be an American. But when the car came to take her to the airport, it was just too late. Full of impulses, she was. I think I inherited some of them.
She prattled on. There was not much remarkable about her early life, but I think she enjoyed herself in summarizing it and forgetting where we were for a while. I enjoyed listening to her babble of the familiar and amusing things that had all vanished from the world outside. We worked lightly through childhood, school days, and coming out, insofar as the term still meant anything.
I did nearly get married when I was 19, she admitted, and aren't I glad now it didn't happen. But I didn't feel like that at the time. I had a frightful row with Daddy, who'd broken the whole thing up because he saw right away that Lionel was a spizzard.
A what? I interrupted.
A spizzard. A sort of cross between a spiv and a lizard.
The lounge kind.
So then I cut my family off and went and lived with a girl I knew who had a flat. And my family cut off my allowance, which was a very silly thing to do because it might have had just the opposite effect from what they intended. As it happened, it didn't. Because all the girls I knew who were making out that way seemed to me to have a very wearing sort of time of it. Not much fun, an awful lot of jealousy to put up with, and so much planning. You'd never believe how much planning it needs to keep one or two second strings in good condition. Or do I mean two or three spare strings?
She pondered. Never mind, I told her, I get the general idea. You just didn't want the strings at all.
Ah, intuitive you are. All the same, I couldn't just sponge on the girl who had the flat. I did have to have some money, so I wrote the book.
I did not think I'd heard quite aright. You made a book, I suggested.
I wrote the book. She glanced at me and smiled.
I must look awfully dumb. That's just the way they all used to look at me when I told them I was writing a book. Mind you, it wasn't a very good book. I mean, not like Aldous or Charles or people of that kind, but it worked.
I refrained from inquiring which of many possible Charleses this referred to. I simply asked,
You mean it did get published?
Oh, yes. And it really brought in quite a lot of money, the film, right?
What was this book? I asked curiously.
It was called Sex is My Adventure.
I stared and then smote my forehead.
Josella Platon, of course. I couldn't think why that name kept on nearly ringing bells. You wrote that thing, I added incredulously.
I couldn't think why I had not remembered before. Her photograph had been all over the place. Not a very good photograph now I could look at the original. And the book had been all over the place, too. Two large circulating libraries had banned it, probably on the title alone. After that, its success had been assured, and the sales went rocketing up into the hundred thousands. Josella chuckled. I was glad to hear it.
Oh, dear, she said. You look just like all my relatives did.
I can't blame them, I told her.
Did you read it? She asked.
I shook my head. She sighed.
People are funny. All you know about it is the title and the publicity, and you're shocked. And it's such a harmless little book, really. Mixture of green sophisticated and pink romantic with patches of schoolgirly purple, but the title was a good idea.
All depends what you mean by good, I suggested. And you put your own name to it, too.
That, she agreed, was a mistake. The publishers persuaded me that it would be so much better for publicity. From their point of view, they were right. I became quite notorious for a bit. It used to make me giggle inside when I saw people looking speculatively in restaurants and places. They seemed to find it so hard to tie up what they saw with what they thought. Lots of people I didn't care for took to turning up regularly at the flat, so to get rid of them, and because I'd proved that I didn't have to go home, I went home again. Book rather spoiled things, though. People would be so literal-minded about the title. I seem to have been keeping up a permanent defensive ever since against people I don't like, and those I wanted to like were either scared or shocked. What's so annoying is that it wasn't even a wicked book, it was just silly shocking, and sensible people ought to have seen that.
She paused contemplatively. It occurred to me that the sensible people had probably decided that the author of Sex is My Adventure would be silly shocking too, but I forbode to suggest it. We all have our youthful follies embarrassing to recall. But people somehow find it hard to dismiss as a youthful folly anything that has happened to be a financial success.
It sort of twisted everything, she complained. I was writing another book to try to balance things up again, but I'm glad I'll never finish it. It was rather bitter.
With an equally alarming title, I asked.
She shook her head. It was to be called Here the Forsaken.
Well, it certainly lacks the snap of the other, I said.
Quotation?
Yes, she nodded.
Mr. Congreve, here the forsaken virgin rests from love.
I said, and thought that one over for a bit.
And now, I suggested, I think it's about time we began to rough out a plan of campaign. Shall I throw around a few observations first?
We lay back in two superbly comfortable armchairs. On the low table between us stood the coffee apparatus and two glasses. Josella's was the small one with the Cointreau. The plutocratic-looking balloon with the puddle of unpriceable brandy was mine. Josella blew out a feather of smoke and took a sip of her drink. Savoring the flavour, she said,
I wonder whether we shall ever taste fresh oranges again. Okay, shoot.
Well, it's no good blinking facts. We'd better clear out soon, if not tomorrow, then the day after. You can begin to see already what's going to happen here. At present, there's still water in the tanks. Soon there won't be. The whole city will begin to stink like a great sewer. There are already some bodies lying around. Every day there will be more. I noticed her shudder. I had, for the moment, in taking the general view, forgotten the particular application it would have for her. I hurried on.
That may mean typhus or cholera or God knows what. It's important to get away before anything of that kind starts.
She nodded agreement to that.
Then the next question seems to be, where do we go? Have you got any ideas? I asked her.
Well,
I suppose roughly somewhere out of the way. Place with a good water supply we can be sure of, a well, perhaps. And I should think it would be best to be as high up as we reasonably can, some place where there'd be a nice clean wind.
Yes, I said. I'd not thought of the clean wind part, but you're right. A hilltop with a good water supply. It's not so easy offhand. I thought for a moment. Lake District? No, too far. Wales, perhaps. Or maybe Exmoor or Dartmoor. Or right down in Cornwall. Around Land's End we'd have the prevailing southwest wind coming in untainted over the Atlantic. That, too, is a long way. We should be dependent on towns when it became safe to visit them again.
What about the Sussex Downs? Gisella suggested. I know a lovely old farmhouse on the north side, looking right across towards Pulborough. It's not on the top of hills, but it's well up the side. There's a wind pump for water, and I think they make their own electricity. It's all been converted and modernized.
Desirable residence, in fact.
It's a bit near populous places.
Don't you think we ought to get further away?
Well, I was wondering, how long is it going to be before it'll be safe to go into the towns again?
I've no real idea, I admitted. I'd something like a year in mind. Surely that ought to be a safe enough margin.
I see. But if we do get too far away, it isn't going to be at all easy to get supplies later on.
That is a point, certainly, I agreed. We dropped the matter of our final destination for the moment and got down to working out details for our removal. In the morning, we decided we would first of all acquire a lorry, a capacious lorry, and between us we made a list of the essentials we would put into it. If we could finish the stocking up, we would start on our way the next evening. If not, and the list was growing to a length which made this appear much the more likely, we would risk another night in London and get away the following day. It was close on midnight when we had finished adding our own secondary wants to the list of musts. The result resembled a department store catalogue. But if it had done no more than serve to take our minds off ourselves for the evening, it would have been worth the trouble. Gisella yawned and stood up.
Sleepy, she said. And silk sheets waiting on an ecstatic bed.
She seemed to float across the thick carpet. With her hand on the doorknob, she stopped and turned to regard herself solemnly in a long mirror.
Some things were fun, she said,
and kissed her hand to her reflection.
Good night, you vain, sweet vision, I said.
She turned with a small smile and then vanished through the door like a mist drifting away. I poured out a final drop of the superb brandy, warmed it in my hands and sipped it.
Never.
Never again now will you see a sight like that, I told myself. Sick transit. And then, before I should become utterly morbid, I took myself to my more modest bed. I was stretched in comfort on the edge of sleep when there came a knocking at the door.
Bill,
said Gisella's voice.
Come quickly, there's a light.
What sort of a light? I inquired, struggling out of bed.
Outside, come and look.
She was standing in the passage, wrapped in the sort of garment that could have belonged only to the owner of that remarkable bedroom. Good God, I said nervously.
Don't be a fool, she told me irritably. Come and look at that light.
A light there certainly was. Looking out of her window towards what I judged to be the northeast, I could see a bright beam like that of a searchlight pointed unwaveringly upwards.
That must mean there's somebody else there who can see, she said.
It must, I agreed. I tried to locate the source of it, but in the surrounding darkness I was unable to decide. No great distance away, I was sure, and seeming to start in mid-air, which probably meant that it was mounted on a high building. I hesitated. Better leave it till tomorrow, I decided. The idea of trying to find our way to it through the dark streets was far from attractive. And it was just possible, highly unlikely, but just possible, that it was a trap. Even a blind man who was clever and desperate enough might be able to wire such a thing up by touch. I found a nail file and squatted down with my eye on the level of the windowsill. With the point of the file, I drew a careful line in the paint, marking the exact direction of the beam's source. Then I went back to my room. End of disc 3.